This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2012 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up, we'll be heading to Kiev to discuss fresh allegations against Julia Tymoshenko with our man there.
We'll hear about the latest protests in Bahrain and how they'll affect the F1 race later this month.
And we'll be talking with the author of a new book, Sandstorm, Libya, The Time of Revolution, to discuss the overthrow of Gaddafi.
We'll also shift our gaze to India, where we'll hear from the organiser of India's first comedy festival.
People in India, especially in Delhi, they need to laugh a lot. They certainly need to have humour in their lives, and I think for that, audiences will come out.
All that, plus some great music too, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24.
And now the latest news from around the world with David Hedges.
Monocle 24 News. Syria has agreed to a United Nations deadline to end a year of violence in the country. The plan calls for a UN-supervised ceasefire by all parties, withdrawal of soldiers and heavy weapons from cities, and delivery of humanitarian aid. UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has told the UN Security Council that Syria has agreed to an April 10th deadline for President Bashar al-Assad to partially implement the peace plan, with a full ceasefire 48 hours later. Violence has continued today, with activists reporting fighting in Idlib and Homs. A court in Pakistan has charged Osama bin Laden's three widows and two daughters with illegally staying in the country. The family of the former al-Qaeda leader has been sentenced to 45 days in jail. The widows, thought to be two Saudi Arabians and a Yemeni, are believed to be detained in a house designated as a jail. The bin Laden family told reporters through their lawyer that they are expecting to be deported.
They have been convicted and sentenced for 45 days imprisonment, and the Secretary of Interior is also directed to make necessary arrangements as per law for their deportation.
Families of those killed in the Falklands War and veterans of the conflict have marked the 30th anniversary of the invasion. Candles were lit during a service at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire. 30 years after Britain and Argentina went to war over the Falklands, relations have reached a new low, particularly after the discovery of oil off the islands. Widow of a Falkland serviceman, Margaret Allen, says today is about focusing on the human cost of war.
It's a special day. It's a special day to remember and reflect. Obviously my husband first and foremost, and really all of those who took part in that conflict, and the family members in addition who suffered really quite seriously after those experiences.
A Russian passenger plane has crashed and burst into flames after takeoff in Siberia, killing at least 31 of the 43 people on board. 13 survivors were pulled from the wreckage and rushed to hospital by helicopter, but one later died. Investigators say the most likely cause of the crash is a technical malfunction. The 21-year-old twin-engine turboprop plane was on a flight to the oil town of Surgut. The crash exposes Russia's poor air safety record, which Vladimir Putin is expected to tackle on his return to the Russian presidency. A twin bomb blast has hit a busy market in the northern Afghan province of Baghlan, apparently targeting a senior Afghan official. The blast left at least 23 people wounded, including 8 policemen. It comes as NATO reveals the majority of attacks by Afghan security forces on NATO soldiers are driven by those with personal grievances and not by insurgents. Brigadier General Carsten Jacobsen of NATO's International Security Assistance Force says procedures to spot personal stress and gripes must be improved.
So far, in the first 3 months of this year, we had 17 service members that lost their lives in 10 separate incidents. One of the things that we are finding is that in many cases, there were signs and symptoms that could have been seen, and leadership has to be improved to make sure that those signs are seen in future, in time, before an incident happens.
Unemployment in Europe has reached its highest level since the start of the euro, with more than 70 million people out of work. Joblessness in the 17-nation currency zone rose to 10.8% and is expected to go higher this year. Meanwhile, Greece's most influential think tank says its economy will contract by 5% this year, taking a more pessimistic view than the European Commission and the IMF. As the country approaches elections next month, it casts a cloud over government efforts to meet fiscal targets. Yanis Stonaris of the IOB Policy Institute said the government in Athens had cut investment spending too sharply.
Well, it is a gloomy forecast because, as you know, the dynamics are still negative, but we have the elements for a recovery. So this is the good thing. But, of course, we have to wait until elections to see what's going to be the new government, what's going to be the new programme.
Officials from the European Union, including Britain, say they are encouraged by Burma's by-election over the weekend, which saw pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi win a seat in parliament and her party take a landslide victory. A small number of officials from Western countries and ASEAN nations were invited to attend the polls. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David. Quick look now at the latest front pages from Down Under.
Hello, Clemency.
Hello.
Good to see you there. Well, I've got The Press, which is, I think we were trying to do the Antipodes newspapers, but we certainly don't have them all here. We've got two for New Zealand, and I'm going to start with The Press, and they lead with a story from Christchurch, which is a story that we've been dipping into quite a lot, which is the consequences of the February 2011 earthquake. And that's yet another building that's about to be pulled down. And it's extraordinary when you see the impact that's still kind of hitting this small city. And we've also covered the exodus of people there. And they have a very nice picture of a mother whose five kids, there's four of them there, four kids had been born in this hospital. And then the other lead story on the paper is that they are also looking at the threat of a quake in the Alp region of the Southern Ireland, but they're saying that doesn't seem imminent. So it just makes you realise that even all this time later, they're still really kind of concerned about what's happening with the earthquakes there.
Also in New Zealand, the Herald are running with my crazy, insane $26 million shock. An unemployed 34-year-old bachelor who works in a supermarket checkout has won the Powerball lotto. Quite extraordinary life news for him. He's just having a couple of Heinekens at the moment, trying to let it all sink in, apparently. He comes from a tiny little town with a population of 1,200 people. Apparently, he still needed to borrow $50 from his parents so that he could celebrate with them.
The only thing is, not for long. It's quite sweet, that story, isn't it? Because obviously in America, somebody just won $400 million last week. So in comparison, I think it feels a little bit of a tiny story, poor New Zealand.
Everything relative, though.
But I wouldn't mind it.
Also, they're talking about a rather worrying rise in sex attacks, particularly in schools. Overall, the crime rate is down, but the sex crime statistics for 2011 are rather worrying. Worrying trend they're reporting out there.
Okay, well, we've done the New Zealand headlines, so perhaps we should now get the world weather with Mr. Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
The weather in northern and western Europe will be getting colder and colder over the coming days. Night frosts and even snow in some countries, particularly cold in the United Kingdom, northern Germany, Scandinavia, and parts of eastern Europe, and it'll stay like it through most of the week. And to think that last week felt almost like summer. In the central Mediterranean, however, it remains pleasantly warm. On to Tuesday's city outlook. In London, 12 degrees with some rain. Copenhagen, 3 degrees with a rain and snow mix. Barcelona, 16 with thunder showers. But in Rome, it's 21. It's partly cloudy too. Over to North America, if you're anywhere on the Atlantic coast of the US, the chances are the weather will be fairly pleasant, not too cold and not excessively warm for the time of year in the Big Apple. In the Midwest, however, the weather looks a little more changeable and tornado season continues across the central US, storms likely from Texas to Kansas through Tuesday. Here is Tuesday's city outlook. In New York City, around 18 degrees with sunshine. Chicago, 16 with sun and showers. Dallas, 26 thunderstorms possible. And in Los Angeles, it's 23 degrees and it's sunny. And now we'll look at some other parts of the world. In Tokyo, looking wet and windy into Tuesday, quite stormy weather over much of Japan, generally speaking, especially northern Honshu. Could even be some disruptive weather to transport and businesses. In Hong Kong, pleasant though, 23 degrees here with sunshine and perhaps a shower. And in Sydney, if you're here, great weather, mid-20s and mostly sunny. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
It's 18:09 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Who's écoutez Monocle 24?
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Malatya.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkosov.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Andrew Tuck. Last year's Formula One race in Bahrain was cancelled following the fatal crackdown on protesters opposed to the ruling Al Khalifa dynasty. Now critics are lobbying for F1 to cancel this year's race, which is scheduled to start on the 20th of April. At the weekend, protests broke out in villages surrounding the capital, Manama, and it's alleged that the authorities responded by firing live rounds at demonstrators.
So, should the race go ahead? To discuss this, we're joined by Ted Kravitz, a Monocle 24 presenter and also a leading Formula One race commentator. Ted, nice to see you in a slightly different seat for once.
Hello, Andrew. Yes, talk about a different and rather less savoury subject.
Yes. So a really basic question. It's obviously a year since the race was cancelled in Bahrain. Do you think that there is enough pressure on the Formula One authorities that they would ever consider cancelling at this time?
Well, I think it's got too late. The previous race that was cancelled at the end of February. Logistics are big in Formula One. Teams need to know what circuit they're going to, where to transport their people, where to transport their cars. And we've got to the point now we're only 3 weeks or so ahead of the race. So I think time is really running out. I think the appetite is not there to cancel the race. So I think something will have to go much more grievously wrong in the next couple of days for the race to be cancelled at this stage.
Is the appetite not there to cancel? I mean, obviously, it's hugely prestigious for Bahrain to have it. They had to cancel it last year. As you say, a lot of people, certainly within Formula One, but also in the country, perhaps don't want this cancellation
Indeed.
To go ahead. So is enough being done, though? I mean, you know, Damon Hill last year, I know, described it as akin to it's apartheid South Africa, really,
Indeed.
In terms of holding this event. So
no, and you know, we can talk a little later about sport and politics and how it doesn't particularly tend to mix. The appetite might be there from many people around the world and many right-thinking people that might consider that actually the thing to do is not to go with sport, which is effectively people having fun, it tends to be, in a country that's got so many problems at the moment. Unfortunately, it's not really down to everybody looking at it from an outward perspective. The appetite is there from the organisers, the Formula One boss, Bernie Eccleston, and from the country itself. And they're the people who will decide whether it happens or not. And like it or not, they're the ones who don't really feel like cancelling it for many reasons, the primary one, of course, being money.
And in recent years, was the cancellation in Bahrain last time one of the first times that it had been cancelled because of political pressures?
Well, it was, but that was pretty much the first time a race has been cancelled because of political pressures. But that was right in the middle of what was, of course, seen the Arab Spring. It was just 2 months after the uprisings that had happened in Bahrain that followed everything else in Tunisia and Egypt. So it was very much fresh in the mind. But we did think at the time, well, we're only going to have these problems 12 months down the line. And so it's come to pass again. And I think the trigger for it is that everybody in Bahrain is now staging protests. People are coming out into the street. People are being shot. There was a 22-year-old man, a citizen journalist called Ahmed Al-Samadi, who was shot by some people in unmarked Toyota Land Cruiser just on the weekend. It's not clear who exactly was. The Bahrain authorities are saying that it was a murder, plain plain and simple, but all his cohorts and his friends are saying that it was the government. We don't know.
The crackdown certainly, though, was very heavy-handed and nasty last year, and as you say, hasn't really addressed the underlying problems, particularly the discrimination against the majority Shia community. Mm. So, I mean, the US Fifth Fleet is there in Bahrain. The West have significant leverage over the government. Should we be doing more? Because Bahrain has a big opportunity to address what's really going on underneath, and it is symptomatic of issues and tensions in the wider Middle East region.
Well, it is, but this also goes back to the US role in all of this. You say that their major surface, some of their major surface fleet is in Bahrain. You know, the Obama administration has been decidedly quiet on Bahrain. Secretary of State Clinton, Hillary Clinton, has had a few words to say. There's been nothing like the reaction to Syria, although the bloodshed hasn't been as bad as Syria, of course. But there have been muted responses from the US. There have been similarly muted responses from the UK. Bahrain is seen by the UK authorities as a friend of Bahrain and a friend of the UK. So it's difficult to say. What I think will probably happen is that the race will go there. We, as journalists covering it, will display, you know, what's happening. We have to go out there and cover it, have to bear witness. That's what we're there for, not only to cover a sporting event. And we'll see whether the sport really has a future in Bahrain. I have a feeling, because of the amount of investment that Bahrain has in motorsport, and it's a long-term player in Formula One, it will stay and having a race, a worldwide sporting event, the world-class sporting event in that country, whether we like it or not.
And Ted, can you give us some idea of what, you know, Bahrain has kind of riding on this, as it were? You know, how much money have they invested in it? How much is their national brand now associated with pulling off an event like this? Because I think it has a, obviously has a consequence for your economy. If you can show you can do these things efficiently and well, it brings in, you know, investors from around the world, I guess.
I mean, as far as, you know, viewing figures goes, Formula One is second after the World Cup. And so for a country like Bahrain, small country by their own admission, to hold a world-class sporting event, it rather puts them up there. Now, the fear is that they're using Formula One as a cleansing agent to cleanse the country of some of their outward image problems. And really, that's the fear within Formula One. Now, attached to that is the fact that Formula One is a sport that's powered by major companies sponsoring cars. And that's the third problem, really, apart from the image and the moral issue that Formula One faces. Do companies such as Vodafone, Mercedes, Renault, you know, big companies like that, worldwide companies that have their own issues in terms of keeping a clean image, want to be associated with Bahrain? If they turn round and say we're not going, now that will be the real clincher. That will be the decider. But they haven't shown any signs of doing that as yet.
And then we go back to the apartheid question in a way. I mean, the question, I suppose, do Bahrain's Sunni elite, should they be allowed to bask in the glory of that major international sporting event? And is it incumbent upon those big companies to say, I'm sorry, we don't want blood on our hands, we're pulling out?
I don't know. It's not for me to say. I'm just a journalist covering the sport. But, you know, you have to look at sport and politics. You know, the 1936 Berlin Olympics. You know, if we were to go back now and say this is obviously, you know, Hitler and the Third Reich trying to legitimise what they're doing, I'm sure we'd have something different to say. The 2008 Beijing Olympics.
But we know what they're doing. We know what's happening. We know that that crackdown was extremely brutal.
We
and
do.
Those questions are remaining unaddressed, really.
No, indeed they are. And you know, we all know that sport is being used as a political tool here, but what's going to
which
happen?
Which is nothing new.
Which exactly, and you know, we can only look at. I mean, there are plenty of other places that Formula One goes, which have dubious human rights records. Not, I'm going to China in a week and a half's time. Mm. You know, we don't need to say anything more about their human rights record. But still, you know, you have the Masters tennis there, you have cricket. You know, you have cricket that can't even go to Pakistan anymore because the troubles are there. They have to play in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So it's really a difficult one, and one that Formula One will have to deal with.
Well, Ted, just before we go, can you just quickly finally tell me, as a personal reflection, when you're travelling with the Formula One teams, is it very isolated from what's going on in the cities? Do you feel a bit kind of hermetically sealed off?
It is. I mean, you'll hear all the team bosses say, oh, we don't feel at all in any danger, that's because they stay in the Ritz-Carlton, they get in a car, the highway is secured between the Ritz-Carlton and the circuit, you know, and they're never going to see anything. We stay in rather more less salubrious areas of Bahrain. I've never felt particularly unsafe in Bahrain. I mean, I've been stabbed once in my life, and that's been in North London. So I've never felt really in any way unsafe in Bahrain. It only takes one thing to happen. It only takes some burning tires to be, you know, thrown in, and somebody has a road accident or somebody to get hurt, for this whole thing to change. And then you'll find the sponsors pull out, and then the media will pull out, and then we'll have a very different situation.
Well, Ted Kravitz, stay safe in Bahrain. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. This week, we highlight bright and shiny hardware at the Singapore Air Show.
China marketed its upcoming C919, while on the smaller end, the Mitsubishi Regional Jet made its cabin mock-up premiere, complete with a sushi bar in the stand. The first commercial jet ever made by a Japanese company, it's another promising model.
This and over 250 more films to be found in the program's menu on monocle.com.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One. Former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko faces probing from government officials over her involvement in tax evasion dating back to the 1990s, opening a new legal front against the one-time Orange Revolution leader.
Tymoshenko, the fiercest opponent of President Viktor Yanukovych, was sentenced to 7 years in prison last October for overstepping her powers in forcing through a gas deal with Russia in 2009. She denies any wrongdoing in a case that had been widely criticised for being politically motivated. Joining us on the line to discuss the case further is Monocle's Kiev contributor, Bruce Leishman. Bruce, thank you for joining us. First of all, could you just tell us, is there an element of surprise that there's another round of charges against her, or was this foreseen for some time?
Yeah, there have been stories circulating for a while now that there's a whole kind of team down at the prosecutor's office who are, you know, really sifting through Tymoshenko's past. Now, you know, whenever Tymoshenko is written about in the media, you know, it's generally said that, you know, she made her fortune, you know, in post-Soviet Ukraine in the shadowy world of gas trading. So it's fair to say if they're looking for something in Tymoshenko's past, they're going to be able to find, you know, something there.
And can you just tell me, you know, surrounding her, you know, that in the past she's been backed obviously by her party. I know that her husband left the country at one point. You know, her daughter was trying to kind of back her up in public. Does she have a kind of support network in public who are trying to kind of combat these allegations? Or has she been isolated slightly by recent events and her imprisonment?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I went for a walk this evening down to the on the main street where there has been, since her trial last summer, a sit-in protest, which is actually outside the Benison store and the Crocs shop. I went past this evening. It was basically deserted, and it's been pretty deserted since, of course, the winter when it was kind of minus 30 here for about 4 weeks in a row. But the weather has turned, and the people really, really haven't gone back, which reflects, unfortunately, a slightly apathetic kind of position that it's taken amongst the Ukrainian population generally when it comes to politics, but also, you know, her party really was waning, you know, and her political prospects were really tarnished by her time as prime minister in a really dysfunctional government. So she doesn't have a huge degree of support out there, whether it is, you know, a political party behind her or really a mass movement on the street.
Bruce, can you give us a sense of how these new allegations against Tymoshenko might affect Ukraine's cooperation with the EU and the West in general?
Yeah, look, you know, it's fair to say, though, that Ukraine was fairly ambivalent to the West's opinion of its conduct of Tymoshenko's trial in the first place. So you'd have to say that, you know, Ukraine has shown itself to be fairly resilient to criticism. But this is in the context of the negotiation of an agreement between EU and Ukraine, which is actually one of the most significant agreements the EU has ever entered into with a non-EU state. And it could be huge for Ukraine. It really opens up Ukraine for trade and investment. And you have to remember, in Ukraine, you know, Kiev is a 90-minute flight from Vienna. You know, this really is, you know, really is, you know, on the doorstep of Europe, already a part of Europe, and should have a great future. But that really is being jeopardized by the actions in Tymoshenko, and you don't really know to what extent this is driven by this extreme personal animosity between the current president and Tymoshenko. And he really does, from what we understand, feel personally, you know, very bitter about the events of the Orange Revolution.
And just tell me, Bruce, what's interesting is I imagine that, you know, when we see it in Russia as well, that anybody who really made a fortune during the time of the collapse of the old Soviet Empire, to be honest, most of them didn't have exactly clean hands. So although she's been targeted, do you imagine that there are other people who are kind of well aware that they could be next if they kind of step out of line now with this slightly harder line government?
Yeah, you know, this is the thing that everyone's questioning, particularly when, you know, the current government, it has to say, you know, is fairly well known to have its fingers in lots of pies around the place. So, that, you know, everyone's saying, you know, if you apply the same rules that have been applied to Tymoshenko, you know, how does that play out, you know, with indeed, you know, the entire current, you know, the majority of the current government? And if they were to be subject to the same rules, you know, what indeed would happen then?
Bruce, just very quickly, supposing that Tymoshenko does win her appeal, how long will she have to wait before she's released?
It's going to be it's a very drawn out political judicial process. So it would be at least another 6 months, I think, in an appeals process. But it really looks like, I think, and then what most people on the ground here are saying, is that until there is a change of government on a presidential level, the chances of release are very limited.
Bruce Leishman, our contributor in Kiev, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House.
And now it's time for some music, and this is Black and Blue by Mika Snow. And that was Black and Blue by Mika Snow. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
LDNTYO.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be joined by Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor. But first, here's David Hedges with the news headlines.
Syria has agreed to a United Nations deadline to end a year of violence in the country. The plan calls for a UN-supervised ceasefire by all parties, withdrawal of soldiers and heavy weapons from cities, and delivery of humanitarian aid. UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan has told the UN Security Council that Syria has agreed to an April 10 deadline for President Bashar al-Assad to partially implement the peace plan, with a full ceasefire 48 hours later. A court in Pakistan has charged Osama bin Laden's three widows and two daughters with illegally staying in the country. The family of the former al-Qaeda leader has been sentenced to 45 days in jail and then is expected to be deported.
Officials from the European Union, including Britain, say they are encouraged by Burma's by-election over the weekend, which saw pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi win a seat in parliament and her party take a landslide victory. A Russian passenger plane has crashed and burst into flames after takeoff in Siberia, killing at least 31 of the 43 people on board. 13 survivors were pulled from the wreckage and rushed to hospital by helicopter, but one later died. Families of those killed in the Falklands War and veterans of the conflict have marked the 30th anniversary of the invasion. Candles were lit during a service at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire. And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Well, it's Monday, which means it's time to check in with Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to hear what's happening in the world of affairs this week. Welcome, Steve.
Hello.
And what are you going to lead? So this is where you kind of run us through the kind of key events that are going to be shaping our week.
Yeah, sort of three
or
things.
Or your version of the key events are going to be shaping our week.
Or three things I think are quite important for you to keep your eye on over the next 7 days. Let's start with Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi's election victory, and also just the size of it. I mean, this was 45 by-elections. They seem to have won at least 40 seats, which is an astonishing victory. What will be interesting to see over the next few days, hopefully will become a little clearer, is what impact this actually might have in Burma. Is there any way that the government, the military-backed government, is actually going to let them do anything?
Honour this.
Yeah, is there an actual, we know there's a proper parliament, because you can see it in the new issue of Monocle, but is it a parliament that can actually make decisions? That would be the thing that would be interesting.
And what's your suspicion as well, whether she wants to engage with that? Obviously, she wants to be in parliament, but do you think that she already has her eye on bigger prizes, or that she already realises it's a flawed process and she'd be better to be the kind of the critic on the side?
I think she wants to engage. I think, from the very start in this process, she's made it quite clear that this is this is the way to deal with it. They've tried boycotting elections in the past, and it hasn't really worked. She was very clear she wanted the West to engage with the Burmese government. She wouldn't have, Hillary Clinton would not have gone to Burma without Aung San Suu Kyi's agreement. So she clearly thinks that it's worth engaging with. The government's made some changes. It's not a military junta anymore, although it's obviously backed by that. But the key thing will be, can this group of MPs in Parliament actually do anything? Will they be able to make any difference?
Do we have a sense of her state at the moment? Because she obviously has been very ill and looking increasingly frail.
Yes, yeah, she was. I mean, she had to take some time off campaigning because, you say, she was... she was quite ill. And, you also look at what she's gone through over the last, 24 years since she... since she won the last proper elections in Burma in 1988, she's been arrested, she's been put in jail, she's been held under house arrest, she's been released, she's been held under house arrest again. Her health has really suffered. But I think, you saw in the last few days of the campaign, relatively lively and, making jokes and seeming to enjoy herself. Who knows what's going to happen over the next few days, but certainly interesting to see now there's been an election. Will these MPs actually be able to do anything?
And Steve, what should people do if they want to see what it looks like inside the Burmese Parliament?
They should buy the new issue of Monocle.
Well, the current issue of Monocle. So there's a new one around the corner. They should rush to buy the current issue of Monocle.
There's still a couple of weeks left.
Okay, there's a good insight into parliaments around the world. And one of them we did go and visit was the new parliament in Burma.
Yeah, it only feels like it's not the new issue, Andrew, because we've just sent the next new issue. But that's another 2 weeks away.
Ignore the bickering of these two. It's still on the stand. Yes. Go out and read it.
So where next on the globe for us and me and Clemency to go?
Syria. So Syria, the Friends of Syria meeting in Istanbul over the last couple of days has been rather interesting in terms of how this story is going to progress. This is a group of around 70 nations which are backing to a certain extent the rebels. I say a certain extent because not all of them are willing yet to formally recognise the Syrian National Council as being the legitimate representatives of Syria, in the same way that people were quite happy to represent the Transitional National Council in Libya. Two things have happened. One is there's been an agreement to funnel quite a lot of Gulf cash to the Syrian National Council, which will then go to the Free Syrian Army. And a lot of people are slightly uneasy about this because they're not entirely sure if they want to get into the business of essentially arming one side in a civil war. But that is what they're sort of tiptoeing towards. This money is mainly going to go, so they say, towards paying soldiers and encouraging people to defect. There's a suspicion that a lot of it will actually go to weapons as well. The other thing that's just happened literally in the last hour or so is that Kofi Annan has briefed the UN Security Council on his six-point plan for some sort of peace deal, ceasefire. Syria says it's accepted it. The US wants there to be a deadline. There also wants to be there to be certain sticks if they don't agree to it. The Russians are, as one would expect, not quite so keen as the Americans.
As you say, as one might expect. Yes. Are they dragging their feet? Are they resisting the six-point plan?
The Russians are kind of not necessarily resisting the plan, but more resisting any sort of encouragements for the Syrians to implement it. So that will be something interesting.
Steve, can you just tell me, what do you think about the Saudi role in this? It's interesting, you know, we've seen Qatar playing a big role in the region over recent months and years, you know, both in soft and hard power. But the Saudis seem to be really going for it. They've kind of nailed their colours to the mast. If, you know, Assad managed to cling on, they've risked a huge amount now in both public diplomacy, in their status and everything, in toppling him.
They wouldn't see it as a risk. They will see this as part of a bigger game, which is using Syria as, you know, as part of a proxy war against Iran. Yeah. I mean, this phase of the Arab uprising needs to be seen through this prism of what's going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Mm. They both have very different goals in the region, very different aims. And you know, as the Russians will say, you know, when they're trying to, you know, defend their actions, they say, well, look, we're, you know, okay, none of these guys are nice, but we're backing the secular dictatorship in, you know, Bashar al-Assad. You, the West, you're in bed with the Wahhabis, with the theocratic dictatorship, the Saudis. We're happy with who we're with. There is an element of that which does make some in the West slightly queasy about who our bedfellows are on this. So, yeah. Is there time for one more?
Yes, if you do it nice briefly. And quickly, I think.
Okay, Mali. There we are.
That's well done.
So, just Mali.
The coup in Mali, I think it's a word of praise is deserved for ECOWAS, which is the regional body of West African states, who have imposed sanctions. They've closed the borders. They've made it very clear they don't want there to be a dictatorship in Mali. They've done this without much involvement from any other from the West, and it seems to be working. Again, worth watching over the next few days.
Steve, thanks so much for coming down to talk about through those stories that will be kind of dominating the week ahead. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're going to be back talking about Colonel Gaddafi's downfall right after this short break.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience. Either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
It's 1840 here in London. The overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi has been captured in a new book by Channel 4 News' international editor Lindsay Hilsum, who was in Libya at the time of his death. Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution, traces the history of his brutal and capricious regime from its beginnings, when Gaddafi had a certain charisma and popular appeal right through to its paranoid and corrupt final state. A little earlier, I caught up with Lindsay to talk about her new book. Lindsay, thanks for joining us on Monocle 24. The overthrow of Gaddafi was one of the defining moments of the 21st century, and you were an eyewitness to the revolution.
Well, I spent most of last year in Libya reporting the revolution for Channel 4 News. That's my normal job as a TV journalist. And I found that people were telling me such extraordinary stories, and I couldn't capture enough of them in a TV news report. I had to write more. And then after Gaddafi was overthrown, I realised there's this moment after a war or a revolution when people are speaking for the first time. And that's an amazing moment to seize on, because these are people who haven't been able to tell their stories, to tell the truth for 42 years. They've been bottling all this up. And what I found was they were just desperate to talk. And these stories were quite remarkable. So the book really is the story of the Gaddafi years and the story of the revolution last year, but through the eyes of the Libyans I met, not famous Libyans, ordinary Libyans, but people who have lived through extraordinary times.
Do you also draw on your experiences in Libya before the revolution?
I didn't actually go to Libya before the revolution. The first time I went there was on the 23rd of February last year, just as the revolution was happening. And one of the things, I felt sort of guilty because I found out that there had been this terrible massacre in a prison, Abu Salim prison, in 1996. When what happened was that the guards and Colonel Gaddafi's brother-in-law, Abdullah Senussi, they got very angry when political prisoners, many of them Islamists, rioted because of the terrible conditions. And what they did was that they herded them into a courtyard. They stationed soldiers all around the roof, and then they murdered the lot of them, 1,270 people. Now, I didn't know about that massacre, and yet I heard about it when I got to Libya, and I realised that it had touched so many people, almost every Libyan. It's got a small population, 6 million people. You kill that many, you touch a lot of families. Mm. And that was what another thing that made me want to write the book, because I felt that this was an untold story.
And is that symptomatic of how his regime was run, in a sense? That appalling story in the prison in 1996.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the human rights abuse went up and down, and that was probably the high watermark. But yes, nobody dared speak, nobody dared form any kind of opposition. And yet, of course, another angle in the book is that the British government and the American government made friends with Gaddafi in the later years.
At one
point in the mid-80s, he was what Ronald Reagan called this mad dog of the Middle East because he sponsored so much terrorism. But after 9/11, he saw very quickly that his enemies were Islamists, jihadis, and the enemies of the West, Al-Qaeda, were jihadis and Islamists. And so a deal with the devil was made, and suddenly Gaddafi, who was an absolute monster, was our new best friend.
Monster he was, but we are also used to the image of Gaddafi as a bit of a buffoon, and sort of he made so many ridiculous and ludicrous decisions in his time. How important is it that we do, or that you do, bring to light again stories such as that of Abu Salim prison, which, as you say, never came to light for most Western eyes at the time?
Well, I think it is important, but I mean, I hope that the book is not without humour, because when you're writing about Gaddafi, you can't help it. And there were most extraordinary things. My friend, the late Marie Colvin of the Sunday Times, she knew him very well, interviewed him many times. And he was a bit weird about women. And I remember one occasion she told me that she had gone to interview him, and he said that he wouldn't talk to her until she put on a pair of little green shoes.
What?
She said, "No, thank you very much. My feet are too big." He was obsessed with powerful women. Mm. He had this thing. He asked Marie again. He said, "Do you know Madeleine Albright? Can you speak to her?" And Marie thought, "Oh gosh, you know, I'm going to get some sort of major scoop. He's going to tell me something which is going to change the affairs of the world." No, no, no. He said, "I want her telephone number, and tell, because I love her, tell her if she feels the same about me, she should wear green in her next television appearance." Because green was his favourite colour. So the craziness of it, you can't help but laugh, even though it's appalling. And another thing I found was that Libyans had a fantastic sense of humour in Benghazi at the beginning of the revolution, that's in the east where the revolution first started, I asked somebody to translate a piece of graffiti for me, and they said, oh, that says, Gaddafi, you are the weakest link. Goodbye.
He was famously described as having a split personality, both of them evil. You open with a description of his death that almost presents him as a victim. He goes through hell, you say, and it is a cruel culmination of his rule, an act of extreme violence towards him. By the end, he was, as you say, such a figure of such ridicule, such loathing. Are you perhaps hinting that there's another way of looking at him in those moments before he died?
Well, I think that his death was shocking. And he was set upon by a mob. And what they did to him, I mean, they tore him limb from limb.
Deservedly so?
He was sodomised. I would never say deservedly so, because I don't think any human being should be treated like that.
Despite what he did.
Despite what he did. But I think that what the book does, maybe I start with that particularly horrific scene, but maybe by the end of the book you understand why it happened. I don't condone it or justify it, but I do understand.
Do you think the Libyan uprising was different from what was happening elsewhere in the Arab world?
Yes, because I think that Libya was the only true revolution. It was the only one where the state, such as it was, and it was a very weak state under Gaddafi, was completely upturned. It's year zero now in Libya. Whereas in Tunisia, I think that the state was sort of hijacked for a while by Ben Ali, and now they've got back to some kind of approximation of democracy. And in Egypt, it was really a military coup in the guise of a revolution, and that's what they're struggling with now. But Libya, everything has changed because Gaddafi was the centre of power. He was the spider in the middle of the web, and there was nothing else.
As you say, at the heart of the book is an analysis of how the Libyan people were able to overcome the fear of four decades of repression and actually find the strength to rebel against him. Can you give us an idea of the sorts of personal human stories that we're going to come across in your book?
Well, for example, Nizar and Mervat were two young people in Tripoli, brother and sister, and they didn't want to fight. They didn't feel they could pick up a gun, so they decided to go for civil disobedience. And one of my favourite stories is how they got a sound system and they put on four sound systems. They recorded 10 minutes of silence and then the revolutionary anthem multiple times. Every Thursday in their neighbourhood, people would put out the rubbish in black plastic bags. They put the sound systems in black plastic bags and then drove off. So suddenly, in the middle of May, the rubbish began to sing. And the rubbish sang the revolutionary anthem. We have thrown off our fetters, we shall be free. Libya, Libya, Libya. And Mervat was filming from the car with her little iPhone in a tissue box with a hole cut in it for the lens. And that was very dangerous. If she had been caught, that would have been Abu Salim, prison for her. And she knew that. But she wasn't caught. And her description of how a kid suddenly shouts, it's in the trash, and somebody comes and picks it up, and somebody else says, no, no, don't pick it up, leave it there. And everybody's looking. And I thought that was an amazing story. And Mervat's husband was not very happy about her participating. He was worried for her. And when she showed him that, and he said, that's our dashboard. You filmed that, didn't you? Because she hadn't told him before. And she said that was the moment that he knew he couldn't stop her. And she had lost her fear.
Year zero in Libya now. Are you feeling optimistic about the challenges they face?
I want to be optimistic. It's a rich country with oil and gas, only 6 million people. It's a well-educated country. People have travelled a lot. There's no reason why they shouldn't make it work. However, they're human beings, and human beings usually mess things up. And this issue of the legacy of Gaddafi, I think, is really what I end with in the book. Because you can't go from dictatorship to democracy overnight. It doesn't work like that. And there are so many divisions in the society between different tribes, between different towns, between Islamists and secularists. And the only way people know how to settle disputes is by violence. And now everyone thinks that if they want something, they should just go on a protest, go on a march. And yet, of course, it's not like that. You have to build a country. They're starting from scratch. It's going to be very difficult.
And that was Lindsay Hilsum, author of Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. Clemency, an amazing interview. Mm. And It's interesting, you often think of these kind of war reporters rolling into town, then rolling out, and that's the end of it. But she's obviously got a real connection with what happened there in Libya, and the stories that you got out of her about the kind of these personal acts of defiance are incredible.
Well, she did say that she'd fallen in love with the country, and it seemed from our interview that she was very, very taken, as you say, with these human stories. You know, I think with a revolution like Libya's, which was so extraordinary, unprecedented, and as she made the point, very different from other sorts of uprisings, whether Bahrain, as we were talking about earlier, or certainly in Egypt. And it, of course, that was led solely by those people. But huge, difficult questions now as to how those people who have been living under that regime for 42 years, how they now begin to govern themselves as they go forward. But no, she, I mean, absolutely superb reporter for Channel 4 News, and great that she found the time on her way to her book launch to pop in and talk
and
to us.
And interesting the point that you start with, that idea of this kind of this terrible description of his killing, which, you know, kind of makes the kind of reader, I presume, have some sympathy for him in his final moments. You know, it was something we talked about in the very early days of Monocle 24. It was an extraordinary image. But again, I guess when you're presenting the TV news, it has to be coloured and cleaned up in a certain way. It sounds as though this book kind of is a slightly no-holds-barred about what it was really like being there.
Yeah, she's certainly doesn't hold back in terms of that description, which is on the opening page. And I was quite surprised, as I said. I mean, she definitely says Gaddafi went through hell in those moments, and talks about the fact that it was an act of extreme violence against him, and that it was a rather cruel culmination of everything he'd come to. And I was amazed by that description, because of course we're so used to now the sort of total vilification of him. But it's a very, very, very interesting read.
Well
worth it.
Great interview. You're listening to Midori House, and we're back with something a little bit lighter after this.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Tagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, over the weekend, the very first Indian comedy festival was held in New Delhi. Not quite on the same scale as comedy festivals in Edinburgh or Melbourne, but stand-up comedy has only really been around in India for a few years. The festival featured a handful of comics, including India's most popular act, Papa CJ, as well as film screenings and an amateur comedy competition.
Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Aarti Bettigeri, went along to catch some comedy and spoke to the festival's organiser, Jatin Varma. He admitted that the Indian comedic scene is not exactly highbrow.
Most of the comedy that you get to see on Indian popular culture is based around Bollywood, and Bollywood thinks everyone in India is pretty stupid. So the type of quality of humour that comes out is really bad. That doesn't mean everyone is horrible. There are some really good writers and people doing a lot of great work, and some of them are at this festival, and we're hoping to highlight them.
So the very first ever festival of its type is just 2 days long. Was it difficult to fill the 2 days?
In terms of filling it with content, it wasn't so difficult. Convincing a lot of people that that audiences would come for something like this was. And I don't think it'll get easier in the coming years either. But I think people in India, and especially in Delhi, they need to laugh a lot. They certainly need to have humour in their lives. And I think for that, audiences will come out.
Now, I know that Indian people have got a very long legacy of comedy, whether it be through movies or theatre, but stand-up as a form of storytelling is relatively new. Why is that?
There is a certain type of stand-up that is done in India. It's called Hasse Kavis. It's poetry-based, though it's a lot of people say it's a dying format. There are not many Hasse Kavis around these days. Stand-up comedy in the Western format is something that's come up in the last few years, and it's growing. It's right now doing very well in restaurants and cafes and bars. We're hoping with our festival we prove that stand-up comedians in India can actually bring in audiences, and for some of the shows it's sold out right now, so they certainly are.
But certainly when it comes to subject matter, there's quite a few no-go zones. I mean, there are many, many minorities and many communities who take offence very easily.
Yeah, you don't actually have to be a minority. You can be in the majority and still get offended, and people can land in trouble. Sometimes people can get into trouble for the most mundane things. Politics, religion especially, caste obviously, a lot of things that are taboo and you shouldn't make fun of them. But the thing with this westernized format of stand-up, which is taken up, is that it's performed in front of live audiences. Generally, half of them are drunk. So people do bring in such topics. But I think, yeah, everyone has a line which they don't cross. Internal sensor built in. And until we change ourselves as a society, that's always going to be there. I think that's one of the reasons we're doing this festival. We need to take ourselves less seriously and be very strong about who we are, because just because someone makes a joke about one particular fact of our society or our culture doesn't mean that it's actually real and we should be able to take it. Banning a book without reading it is, in my opinion, very stupid. But you know, when it comes to people doing live stand-up, a lot of people get away with it by doing certain risque jokes, simply because the people in the audience who are coming to watch them aren't ever going to get offended by it. It's also a lot of people want to just get publicity. That's why they create issues. If there's certainly elections around, then you can get into trouble. But at the same time, I think we do talk about a lot of things. You just never know who can get offended by it. If you're in this business, then you certainly have to be aware and be careful, and at the same time be ready to face something like this.
Is that something that you've been nervous about in organizing this festival?
Not really, because A, we have an agreement with everyone here that whatever they say, it's their own opinion. Second of all, no, I mean, they're all professionals here. I mean, if someone gets offended, I'm really sorry about that. But I honestly have not been. I think we have a pretty safe festival this year.
But think of the great publicity if some religious fundamentalists decide to burn your effigy at the front of Mundy House.
I'll be flattered if I was someone wanted to make an effigy. I want to store it in my, put it up in my place also. But
is that the ultimate sign that you've made it?
Yeah, people burning you on the streets. But I doubt it. I don't think there's anything here which anyone can get offended. And honestly, my opinion is, you know, if you're doing it to offend someone, then that's not really right. I mean, you should do it to make people laugh.
So what is the future for Indian comedy and for the Indian Comedy Festival?
Well, I mean, when you look around in India, even if you don't want to crack a joke, there'll be a lot of things around you which are really, really funny and hilarious. We are, in my opinion, a functioning anarchy at times. I think Indian comedy has a very bright future. I think Indians have a sense of humor which not many people have. We can be very sarcastic. We certainly are very good writers. I think, it's going to go bigger and better, and hopefully the Indian Comedy Festival will be there as part of that whole ride.
That was Jatin Varma, organiser of the inaugural Indian Comedy Festival, speaking there with Aarti Bettigeri. Well, that's it from this Monday edition of Midori House from me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Andrew Tuck. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco.